The transition from 2015 to 2016 has been indeed an interesting one. Among many things that happened towards the end of the previous year, we all know what happened in Paris, and for the first time, as a result of it, something happened which the mother has not just prophesied, but she has seen it as a hope that it should happen. She said that America and Russia must come together. At that point of time, it would have certainly looked like an impossible dream. But for the first time, there was a joint action. And though we had to say it, but thanks to the terrorists, darkness served the purpose of light. They came together, and of course, perhaps too close for comfort. almost we slipped past a possible catastrophe when the Russian plane was shot down by Turkey. Very miscalculated, misunderstood, an act which shouldn't have happened. But nevertheless, it showed the possibility of two countries which have been poles apart of coming together for a common cause. Closer at home, the new year started for us literally with a big bang. While perhaps people were celebrating with patakas, the Indian headlines were terrorists sneaking into an Air Force base, and they were playing with live bombs. And that event, really till date, I've been to that base at some point in my career, and it's very surprising that what arrested them. Till date, they are still playing with theories. But to imagine that six heavily armed terrorists armed with grenades, mortars, rocket launchers, whatnot, and they were just 5 minutes walking distance away from the aircrafts which they had actually come to destroy, and they were there for hours. And yet, all that they could do was to inflict a casualty of 7 persons. It's not about right or wrong, but there is some kind of intervention which is very, very palpable. It's impossible. Even today's news, they are not sure how it happened, that how and why they were hiding for so long, going undetected, and while the actual place of their strike was just 5 minutes walking distance, where they could have easily gone with all these heavy things that they were carrying, but it didn't happen. And certain actions which took place during that time reminded me that, you know, when mother writes about psychic memories, so we often think that, you know, psychic memories are only when we go to a religious place or go to a temple and we are, you know, reciting a mantra or doing some puja. But this was another act which I am sure has been engraved in the deep inside as a psychic memory of some of them. One, of course, is very strange, that there was a cook who saw a terrorist literally running with, armed with guns, and this cook, unarmed, ran to apprehend him. Now, who would do this except in a soul moment? This cannot be done by any calculated thought, not even by a, you know, strong vital. Something else overtook him, almost a certitude of immortality, that this cook, unarmed, ran, held the terrorist, killed him, and got killed in the process. But literally it was, I mean, he heard the spray of bullets and looked out and saw this event and went out. Something very strange. It's not an ordinary act by any standard. And the other, where a person who was shot 6 bullets in his abdomen, continued to fight for 3 hours, holding the fort. I can't imagine, you know, it's like, and he's in the hospital now, probably safe, hopefully out of danger, but something took place like an intervention, whatever other reasons may be. And as an aftermath, as if things didn't stop here, as an aftermath we see, again, two countries which could never ever see eye to eye. I mean, they are one country but divided into two. Suddenly speaking of a joint investigation, actually arrest being made in Pakistan for the first time. And though many Indians are full of suspicion, but I think it's a very good step to trust and go forward and see what is happening. I mean, for the first time we see, again, thanks to the terrorists, they became instruments Not just cricket, but even terrorism became an instrument to bring the two countries together. At some point, they are beginning to feel that we have a common enemy and a common problem. And it's not just that somebody else is a problem for us. So, such things, that's how the new year has started. Interesting things, and we hope that this is, of course, the supramental year, so something more special will take place, as always, 15th anniversary of the supramental year. It's interesting that from 56, the mother says that all my conversations after 56 are of a different, not after 56, sorry, after the supramental manifestation, that is 29th February 1956. She says they are of a different category and should be placed as such. It's there in her, documented in her own words. Whereas whatever she has spoken earlier is a different category. And one can see a very clear demarcation. When we read through mother's writings, even the New Year messages, up till 53, there is one kind of message. Then 54, she gives a very interesting message and explains it. She says that, you know, we have a difficult period, and she says that 14 months are going to be very difficult. 55 beginning. 55, she gives a message that no human will can finally prevail against the divine will. 55, January. And when she was asked, she says, 14 months are going to be very difficult. And the disciple asks, why 14, why not 12? She says, why? Well, that's how it is. It's not a question of why. And exactly 14 months from that message, the supramental manifestation took place. And 56, of course, he gave a message, the greatest victories are the least noisy. The birth of a new world is not announced by the beating of drums. Just 2 months before, cautioning us. And again, the disciples asked her mother, are we going to win a great victory? She said, wait and see. She knew it, but she would not pronounce, because every time she would pronounce, all the world forces will rush in to spoil it. So the divine prefers to work it this way, unannounced, without beating anything, and quietly the event takes place, so much so that in the world, just about 5 persons felt something. They had some experience, not that they knew what has happened, but they felt something unusual. 2 in the ashram, 3 outside. This was the quietude. But slowly we see that this new world is really asserting itself more and more, putting a tremendous pressure on humanity, compelling it to change, even the very substance to change. And perhaps through the course of the year, we'll have occasion to read more and more about how the change is taking place and what is our role in it. But today, because it's a new year beginning, new year continues, so I thought we'll read one of our messages from 1957, New Year message. This is the first message she gave for the new year after the supramental manifestation. And the message is very interesting and very powerful and very relevant to what we are experiencing. The onslaught of evil, whether in India, Paris, ISIS, all this, all around the world. What is her solution? Because there are all kinds of solutions that human beings are trying to give. The mother gives a very, very strange, very powerful solution, difficult to comprehend. A power greater than that of evil can alone win the victory. This part looks very obvious. It has to be greater than evil to win the victory. But the next line is totally... It is not a crucified, but a glorified body that will save the world. It's a very powerful line. It's not through simply martyrdom, through making a gospel of despair and vanity of life, but someone who lives in that delight, experiences that delight in the midst of everything, and imposes it on his own being and on everything around, that can win the victory. Quite naturally, the disciples asked her, Mother, will you explain the New Year message? What does it mean? And then the mother gives the background, how she would give the message and why she gave this message. So these messages, as we know, they used to come to her. She would see into the future, she would see into the past, she would know the state of humanity, and then these messages would come, she would give it. She has also said that whatever was given as a message was something which was tried, experimented, tested, confirmed. And then it was given for the rest of the world. Because people often asked her about darshan days, and she said, nowadays, you see, these events, descents take place very unexpectedly after 56. In 58, she says, they take place very unexpectedly and not necessarily on darshan days. But on darshan days, we still use it to give the message to the world by spreading something which has already been tried and tested. And then she gives the background of this message. So she was going to give a message, and then suddenly she had a booklet in her hands which had come from America. And it contained photographs, and the name of the booklet was The Family of Man. There were quotations in this booklet and the reproduction of a number of photographs classified according to the subject, and all for the purpose of trying to awaken the true sense of fraternity in men. So she could feel that aspiration and goodwill that people want. There are some people here and there who want unity and fraternity, but they don't know how. So this was the booklet. The whole thing represented a sort of effort, immense, and then she uses another adjective, pathetic. There is a tremendous urge, but at the end it comes to nothing because we don't have the vision. To prevent a possible war. This, of course, is 1957. She was asked after that several times, on one occasion very directly, will there be a third world war? And she would refuse to give a very direct answer for the same reason. But eventually she said that, let's hope that with the supermind being here, it will avert the possibility of a third world war. Though, of course, humanity will go to its brink. She has gone to the extent of saying that the last asura will die in India. God knows who or what that asura is. She never indicated. The quotations had been shown by a woman reporter who had come here and whom I had seen. And so all this came expressing in a really touching way the best human will which can manifest on earth at present from the collective point of view. And then she makes it clear that I am not talking of individual. From the individual point of view, the best human will can be very, very high. But collectively, we can at least hope to be reasonable enough to live as brothers and sisters in a state of fraternity, in a state of unity. She said that is the highest as of now. I am not saying that some individuals have not risen much higher and understand much better, but they are individual cases. I was moved. How divine is moved? It's very interesting to see how divine gets moved. We think divine is moved by a standard stock prayer repeated like a parrot. But divine can be moved by an aspiration for unity, and the divine is moved. Embodied divine. It's amazing. It's a direct experience that how the mother is moved. I was moved. And then I came to the end of their booklet and to the remedy they in their ignorant goodwill suggested to prevent men from killing one another. Shubhendu speaks of these number of remedies, science, education, which humanity has suggested, even multiplying weapons, paradoxically, that people will not kill each other because they are afraid that they would destroy each other. So many ways, scientific advancement, humanity has suggested. But it was so poor, so weak, so ignorant, so ineffective. In India, there was another remedy suggested, which Shubhendu takes a dig at and laughs, that if you commit sin, you will be punished in another life. And Shubhendu says, whoever stopped sinning because of punishment in another life? So the present terrorists have done one better. So they say, no, if you commit sin, they don't call it sin, of course, they call it jihad, you will go to heaven and enjoy there. This is really going overboard. And the strangest part is that human beings believe in such a thing for the sake of some mythical, very carnal pleasure. They can kill when they could easily have such things here. But that is the power of propaganda and fundamentalism that takes hold of human mind. I was truly moved, and I had a dream that this exhibition would come here to Pondicherry. I am not sure whether we ever had an exhibition, at least not in the last many years, on unity or fraternity or something like that. And maybe this is a very good idea to have it in the supramental year. That we could show it and add a concluding fascicule to their booklet in which the true remedy would be revealed to them. So she wants to give us the true remedy. And that's how this message came. I wrote it down, the remedy, and as soon as it was written, I said to myself, why? This is my message. So she has given a prescription to all of us, individually and collectively. This means that it is just the thing which can make the goodwill of mankind, the best being expressed on earth today, progress. It has taken a rather special form, because this goodwill came from a Christian country. And naturally, there was quite a special Christian influence. That's why she uses the word crucified body. Rather than that, a glorified body. But this is an attitude which is found everywhere in the world, differently expressed according to the country and the religion. We know that in India itself, we have this attitude of Maya, otherworldliness, Nirvana. And we believe that is the solution, not delight. In the original Upanishad, we have delight. But here we have this tendency towards otherworldliness, sacrifice which is like painful self-immolation, giving up external thing, abstention. This is the solution that mankind has suggested to get the spiritual force. Naturally, there is the same idea in India. This idea of the complete renunciation of all physical reality. The profound contempt for the material world, which is considered an illusion and a falsehood, that leaves, as Aurobindo used to say, the field free to the sovereign sway of the adverse forces. So why evil abounds in this world? Because all the good people want to book their tickets to heaven. So terrorists also book their tickets to heaven through a different route. And the good and strong also book their tickets to heaven through another route. So everybody is busy hurrying to heaven. And nobody is left on earth to take up this work, which is so important. Today is also, incidentally, the birth anniversary, as we know, of Swami Vivekananda. And tomorrow of Nalnida. So both great in their own way. Swami Vivekananda, a mighty spark of Shiva, manifesting or emerging through the fire body of Swami Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. Nalnida, a vast, almost not a river, but almost an ocean of knowledge, emerging from the incomprehensible, limitless mind of Sri Aurobindo. That's why he is called as Manasputra. Both great and mighty in their own way. And we see that they have taken a different route. When Sri Aurobindo was asked that, you know, what kind of disciples you have, it would have been much better if you had people like Swami Vivekananda. Why do you have to suffer us ignorant disciples? And Sri Aurobindo takes a dig, and with his characteristic sense of humor, he says, as to the disciples, I agree. I agree. And he also says, kismat. It's my kismat to have such disciples. But then he goes on to say something very interesting. But he says, but as to Swami Vivekananda and men of this kind, it is doubtful if they will ever agree to take up this yoga. And if they take it up, it is very doubtful whether the ordinary humanity in them will not show up under the pressure of the yoga. So it's a different kind of yoga. A difficult path, a different path, where even the best, that which is hidden inside comes to the surface, the ordinary humanity, hidden behind Swami Vivekananda. Sri Aurobindo could see it. But for Nirvana, it's all right. That's the impression in India, that regard all this as an illusion. Those who die, those who slay, they're all basically part of an illusory game. And the solution is to renounce this whole field and get into that other sphere, beyond the sphere of sorrow. In order to go away yourself, to realize what Sri Aurobindo calls here a zero or a void unit, to become the sovereign of a knot, mother's subtle sense of humor, to become the sovereign of a knot, of a zero, it is the return into nirvana. This idea is everywhere in the world, but expresses itself in different forms. Because until now, evil has been opposed by weakness, by a spiritual force without any power for transformation in the material world. This is the big challenge. There have been spiritual force which has converted occasional people who at some point had some kind of a predisposition, but it cannot transform, it doesn't bring that power with it. This tremendous effort of goodwill has ended only in deplorable failure and left the world in the same state of misery and corruption and falsehood. So there is a spiritual solution. Sri Aurobindo gives that even in his Bengali writings, that when you have an enemy far greater and superior to you in strength, physical capacity, everything, then can you beat him? He says, yes, it's possible. He says, how? He says, by the accumulated spiritual force within. That spiritual strength will create means, instruments, everything to defeat the design. So as we were seeing in this example, it may look, but where was the spiritual force and what was its action? I believe that terrorists fight not for ideology and ideas or religion. This is all just a facade. They are simply dark instruments of terror. They want to bring fear into this world. Why? Well, it's like there are people who want to bring fear into the world for no reason. I mean, one sees sometimes a child just picking up a stone to hit a, you know, an animal or a dog who is running a little distance away for no reason at all. I have seen this and I have been appalled. Why this person is doing it? This creature is doing no harm, but they just like it. They like to bring terror and fear. So these people want to bring fear, create the atmosphere of fear. And when one person faces it with courage, like this unarmed cook in the Air Force mess, then it sends ripples of courage which have an effect of wiping away the ripples of fear that they have come to create. And this is one way that this action takes place. It fills men's heart with courage. One person's courageous deed, one person who can experience spiritual force or experience that delight, it has a ripple effect. And this is what acts as a counterbalance. But this tendency to leave the field and run away is on the same plane as the one where the adverse forces are ruling. It is on the same plane as the one where the adverse forces are ruling that one must have a greater power than theirs, a power which can conquer them totally in that very domain. So it's not enough. That's why we see all these avatars. You see, they go to the enemy's territory. In the age of Rama, Rama goes all the way to the territory, to Lanka. He could have had a play where Ravana came and would have finished him. Actually, there was a very close opportunity. It doesn't do that. He chases him and Sita plays the role of drawing Rama right up to the mouth, citadel of darkness. We see Krishna also going all the way to Mathura to kill Kansa. And then all the way to Kuru kingdom to have the battle. It's a very symbolic thing that on the plane where the devil fights, there has to be the victory. Otherwise, in some other plane, in the inner being, we are free, we feel joy and love. When we come to the outer life, we are pathetic. That doesn't help. To put it otherwise, a spiritual force which would be capable of transforming both the consciousness and the material world, this force is the supramental force. It changes even the material conditions, circumstances, even the very material body. That's its beauty. It just doesn't give us only inner experiences that we have had for centuries and centuries and millenniums, but something concrete, something powerful, even in the most material domain. This force is the supramental force. What is necessary is to be receptive to its action on the physical plane. So first thing she tells us that we have to become receptive in the body itself. And not to run away into a distant nirvana, leaving the enemy with full power over what one abandons. And then this is very, very powerful, extremely powerful. It's if supramind or even beyond it could get speech, perhaps this would be the speech. It's not even supramental speech. If I may use the word, it's the speech of the Supreme. Only the Supreme can speak like this. It is neither sacrifice, nor renunciation, nor weakness which can bring the victory. We have been hearing this all our life. Renunciation, sacrifice, says none of these. Very powerful. It is neither sacrifice, nor renunciation, nor weakness which can bring the victory. It is only delight. A delight which is strength, endurance, supreme courage. All these things flow from delight. That's why the mother, as a caution, as its corollary, repeatedly advises us, cautions us, warns us, never fall into the trap of despair. She says, pessimism is the tool of the devil. Whenever the atmosphere becomes grave and serious, know that the devil is nearby around the corner. And she says, to despair means it's the weapon of the demon. That's why he said that these terrorists want to bring fear, despair. Oh, nothing can happen. It's all useless. Oh, supermind, this is a dream. All these thoughts they instill by creating such appearances so that mankind can stop hoping. But here, Shubindo says, the mother says, delight which is strong, because this delight doesn't fade. In the face of adversary, it can smile, it can laugh in the face of the adversary. Therefore, it is strength, it is endurance, it is supreme courage. It melts away fear. The delight brought by the supramental force. So, supermind is not something austere, far, serious, remote, everything that, you know, Shubindo had to remove this impression from the minds of people, because we see externals and with, oh, Shubindo is withdrawn into a room. Maybe if I also withdraw into a room, I will find the supermind. But Shubindo had to undo these notions which were so prevalent. The delight brought by the supramental force. It is much more difficult than giving everything up and running away. So that's what we started, that, you know, two solutions, two approaches. Both mighty, Swami Vivekananda and Nolnida, they took two different lines following their own masters. One, difficult but still a path which has been tried, tested, perfected. The other, also difficult but a path entirely new, like an adventure into the unknown. It demands an infinitely greater heroism. But that is the only way to conquer. So this the mother on the crown, the victory which comes by delight. And so I thought we could end by reading one of Shurbindo's Bengali hymns. Of course, my Bengali is more pathetic than perhaps the exhibition that Shurbindo would have shown. It is just an accidental Bengali living here. You can't do without learning Bengali and Odia. Otherwise, as a doctor, though, you'll be a total failure. And sometimes I just feign that I have understood, and patients are very happy that he has understood. So let me publicly disown this understanding. But faith helps. So anyways, it's enough to know by the body language what's going on, which part of the body. And then we have the science. And above all, there is the grace and the faith. So they overrule all our, you know, faults in communication. And they build a bridge from heart to heart. That is the real bridge, actually. We have to build the bridge from heart to heart, not by learning a language. People who know the same language, who stay in the same house as brothers, they fight. So this solution that by learning a language you can get close to a people, maybe to a very small part of the mind. But people are not just mental beings. And the real source of healing comes from the heart. So it doesn't matter. I mean, if we communicate only from here, intellectual, then eventually we'll end up being divided, like the Punjabis on both sides of the border. Indian Punjabis and the Pakistani Punjabis, they are both Punjabi, they speak similar language. They are very happy when they meet each other. If you hear the two, you will feel they could be on any side of the border. I can say this for sure, knowing about Punjab. But they are fighting with guns and killing each other. So it's not about that, but the beauty of the thought, the feeling, the aspiration Shobhinder has expressed. This, of course, is in English, translated by, I don't know, maybe Nalnida or Arindam Da, who have mostly translated, but there are other translators also. Hymn to dawn. And Shobhinder here speaks of delight. She, the goddess, rises lifting her forward pace towards the vast, the universal. She has put on the robe of light and displays the white brilliance of her subtle norms of truth. Heaven gold is her hue. So this should be the real way for all of us. But it's unfortunate that we have to be woken up rudely by the cry of Kali in the midst of the darkness and silence. When Shobhinder was asked why these methods are used by God, like terrorists creating unity, they don't know this. They will never believe it, that they are the ones who are ultimately uniting the world together. They don't know it, and it's good that they don't know it. They are forces of division. But the thing is that why such methods are needed, Shobhinder says they are needed because man is still too crude. If man can ennoble and refine himself, God will also change his methods into subtle and refined ones. So as we change in consciousness, the divine methods also change. In Tantra, this is very nicely revealed as, you know, at the first stage of Tantra, when the bhakti is like a Pashu, the Lord is Pashupati. Shiva, the Lord of the bull and the Pashu, and he is like Rudra, easy to arouse into wrath, who can slay the Asura. So that is at the first stage. But at the end, the third stage is when Pashupati changes into Gopal. So as the consciousness grows and we become more refined, more subtle, so the divine also from Rudra changes into Shiva, benevolent Shiva, and from Shiva into the luminous and smiling face of Krishna. So this is the evolutionary journey. So here, may the dawn come with her subtle norms of truth. The goddess, all enjoyment she is. She doesn't discriminate. She pours a light on all things. She doesn't say discard this, keep it under corner. She gives a light to all. She comes carrying the sun, the eye of the gods, bringing here the white life steeds that have the perfect vision. She comes, the goddess wholly revealing herself in the rays of the sun. So this is the supramental delight which Shobhinder is speaking of, and this is the early glimpse of that. Behold her in her multiple divine riches. Very different from abandoning everything. Multiple divine riches. Behold her manifest everywhere in all things. Behold her, the mother of radiance. So in way back in ancient India, the outer and the inner were put together. When Yajnavalk goes to the court of King Janak, and King Janak has said, whoever will win the argument or the debate and proves to be the greatest Brahmagyani, he can carry 1,000 cows with both horns tipped with gold. So nobody is willing to start, set the ball rolling. You know, that's the difficult part, the first bowl. So when nobody starts the debate, Yajnavalk says to his disciples, please take the cows with you. So everybody says, do you think you are a Brahmagyani? He says, no, I don't know about that, but I need the cows for my ashram. Very simple answer. I need the cows for my ashram. So take the cows. Then of course Gargi stops and questions him. And a question is again very much otherworldly and thisworldly. And question him and says, you claim to be a Brahmagyani, but you have 2 wives. How can you be a Brahmagyani? How can you even talk about, be qualified to speak about Brahman? And then he reveals the difference between love and attachment. And Gargi is satisfied. And she says, all right, indeed you are Brahmagyani. Then others, couple of them ask questions, but finally they take the verdict of Gargi. So this kind of richness of life, outward and inner, this is how it was there in the ancient times. All delight is within. All that is hostile to man is afar. So let it be in thy dawning. So as she brings delight, and we see it every day, night we may be filled with all kinds of dark thoughts. Human beings mostly have this seesaw. Unless divine presence is settled in the heart in the day as in the night, that lovely prayer Shrivindu gave to Champaklal. In the day as in the night, in sleep as in waking, be always in us constantly as truth, consciousness. Let me feel in me always and at all times truth, consciousness and bliss constantly and at all times. So this, you know, day and night. But normally we see that with the fall of evening and towards night, consciousness also tends to gravitate towards inertia and all the things that are dark. Thoughts can come partly because we are fallen back upon ourselves, our petty miserable life. Pains increase. Most human beings will experience maximum pains at night. Because daytime, you know, there is so much richness, life force, radiance, light, everything, hope. But again in the morning, the heart is filled with hope and joy. Darkness gets chased away. So here is this inner and the outer action. Build our pasture of infinity. Illumined with truth. Build our home of delight, freed from fear. By the very fact that one cannot experience delight as long as there is any kind of fear in the being, any trace of fear. It's the impurity which has to be out for delight to be built up. Drive away all that divides and antagonizes. Automatically, when we are in a state of delight, then there is a state of unity. Division ceases. Spontaneously, this delight contacts every other point of delight in everyone. Bring to us all the wealth of the human soul, O Mother of Plenty. Send forth into life all the plenitude of delight. Goddess Dawn, manifest thyself in our hearts in the play of the supreme effulgence. Widen the life of the embodied being. Once again we see widening of the life. But Nirvana is a path of narrowing of life. The mother says that we end up giving this, giving that. Eventually, in our rush for Nirvana, we start, no, this should be given away, this we should not have, and at the end we have nothing. And then she says with her own subtle sense of humor, well, if the God wanted only Nirvana, there would be nothing else but Nirvana in the world. But he wants creation and its many-foldedness and the delight of creation. Widen the life of this embodied being. O Mother of Delight, give us stable impulsion. Give us that plenty whose wealth is the luminous herd of truth, the inner wealth, which gives value to outer wealth. If one is poor inwardly, then even if one has a lot of wealth, one always feels like a miser. Somebody has said very beautifully that we are not rich by the wealth that we have. But we are rich by the wealth that we can give, because, you know, then we are in a state of abundance. But when we are always hoarding, calculating, seeing how much I have, then obviously it's a state of miserliness, even if one has billions and billions. So inner wealth is the first requirement. Where range the chariots and horses of life moving towards infinity. We are rich in those riches. We, the steadfast aspirants, O Goddess, born in perfection, daughter of heaven, we foster thee with our thought streams. And thou too holdest in our bosom the knowledge won and the vast and the seas of delight. So this is the solution of the divine to grow in the vastness and the delight that brings harmony among all things. So we'll stop here.